said, stretching his arms and folding them behind his head. It is so refreshing to be treated with contempt. I laughed again.
It is not.
Yes, it is, he insisted. I can't tell you how much I enjoy it. He grinned as if he really did enjoy it.
Now you're being absurd.
Actually, I am being quite serious. But knowing your stubborn streak... I cast him a dark look and he chuckled. I'll let it drop for now. Tell me, besides your beauty, what else have you inherited from your mother?
I chose to ignore the first part. She taught me how to paint. She was a talented artist, much more talented than I am. And she loved to ride. She took me riding nearly every day, early in the morning. And she was such a bounding rider that she would take any jump fearlessly, no matter how high it looked. I flinched at the words I had spoken, surprised that they had escaped me.
Is that how she died? Philip asked, his tone respectful.
I looked out the window. I nodded, keeping my gaze on the orchard, imagining I was safely encircled there right now.
Were you with her?
I cleared my throat to speak past the lump that was suddenly there. No, I didn't ride with her that morning. My father found her. I am sure you can imagine the rest easily enough. After a long pause, Philip said,
Actually, I cannot.
I looked at him in surprise. He studied me for a moment, as if choosing his words.
I cannot imagine why your father would take everything from you right after you lost your mother. Your home, your family, your friends, his protection and care.
Philip's words pierced me so sharply, so suddenly, that I felt almost breathless from the pain. He had found so easily what I had been hiding at the very core of my heart. This was why I did not open my heart. This was why I kept it bandaged so tightly. It had been foolish of me to think I could safely unbind it. My eyes pricked with sudden tears. I stood and walked to the window, keeping my back to Philip. The sky was turning dark grey, clouds rolling together. It would rain soon. I pressed my hand against the glass. It felt cool and soothed the aching wounds on my palm. I wished I could as easily find a balm for the ache in my heart. I saw Philip's reflection in the window as he came to stand behind me. I felt his warmth at my back, and I was hot and cold in the same moment. Part of me wanted to lean into the cool glass of the window, away from him, and the rest of me wanted to lean against him, into his warmth. Chapter 10
I'm sorry,
Philip said in a hushed voice as he stood behind me. I didn't know if he felt sorry for what had happened or for asking me about it, but it didn't matter. My defenses were already up. It had been a mistake to make myself vulnerable. Now I wanted to run from this room and go somewhere far away from this man who made me say things I didn't want to say and feel things I didn't want to feel. I stepped aside so I was no longer trapped between him and the window and turned around. "Are you ready to play chess?" I asked in a brisk voice. "Or should we save it for another day?" I did not meet his gaze, and I was already turned toward the door. My emotions were too close to the surface, and I needed to be alone to put them back in their proper places. I was ready to run away. But then Philip touched my arm.
"Wait," he said.
I turned back to him reluctantly.
"Are you hungry?" he asked.
"Actually, yes, I am. I hadn't even realized it.
Will you excuse me for a few minutes? Please, make yourself comfortable."
I watched him walk away with mixed emotions. I was still balanced between hot and cold. I had not decided which way I would fall, away from Philip or toward him. But now that he had left, I did not feel the desire to run away, so I stayed and waited for his return. Choosing a book of poetry from the bookshelf, I sat in a chair by the window and tried to shake off my unsettled mood. I lost myself in the poetry, and when the door opened again, I was surprised to see by the clock on the mantel that half an hour had passed. Philip brought in a tray loaded with food, which he sat on the small table between our chairs.
"I hope you appreciate what I went through," he said. "You should have heard the scolding I received from the cook for raiding her pantry. I was terrified."
I laughed, relieved that he had returned in a less serious mood.
"You were not." "I was," he said with a grin. "There's something about servants who have watched you grow up. They never hesitate to treat you like a child, no matter how old you are."
He picked up a plate.
"What would you like?"
"Oh, I can do that." I set down the book and reached for the plate, but he held it back.
"Nonsense. Allow me to serve you. A little bit of everything."
His eyes twinkled as he smiled at me, and I was surprised by both his gesture and his look.
"Yes, thank you," I said, watching him as he filled the plate with fresh fruits, bread, cold ham and cheese.
I took the food from him with a teasing smile.
"You're not going to insist on feeding me as well, I trust."
"I would if I thought you would let me," he murmured. My face grew hot at the look he cast me from under his lashes.
"Ah, there it is," he said. "I've missed your blush this past half hour."
I glared at him.
"I think you do that on purpose," he chuckled.
"What?"
"Make me blush." "It's the easiest work I've ever done," he said shamelessly, "and the most enjoyable."
I sat there feeling hot and irritated while he poured lemonade into a glass and held it out toward me.
"Thank you," I muttered, reaching for it.
Philip held onto the glass after I had wrapped my hand around it, and I looked up. I was surprised to see his expression completely serious.
"Don't think, because I like to tease you, that I don't take you seriously," he said in a quiet voice. "It is an honor to know what's in your heart, Marianne."
I was so taken aback that I would have dropped the glass if he hadn't still been holding on to it. He set it down on the table and began to dish food onto his plate without looking at me.
Would he ever do something predictable?
I doubted it. I felt off balance, yet at the same time flattered for a reason I couldn't name. I was at a loss as to what to say or do.
I stared at my plate until Philip said, "It's food, Marianne. You're supposed to eat it."
My eyes flew to his face. The amusement I saw there was irresistible. I laughed and started to eat, feeling comfortable once again. Extremely comfortable, in fact. I curled my legs beneath me and looked out the window, content to eat in silence and watch the steady fall of rain. It surrounded the room with a hushing sound and blocked out the rest of the world, hiding the land and orchard from view.
"What a wonderful room," I said. "How long did it take to build up this collection?"
"Only a few generations, actually. My grandfather had a passion for books. Probably half of what you see came from him. My father added to it every time he traveled to the continent. He was always on the lookout for unique books. When he came home, he would invite me in here to look at the new titles. It felt almost as if I had been on his travels with him."
I caught a little nostalgic smile in Philip's eyes.
"And then, when I was on tour, I found myself drawn to little bookstores everywhere I went. I came home a year later with dozens of boxes of books. We arrived just in time, the books and I."
His voice grew quiet. "I was able to show them to my father before he died. It was like one last travel for him."
I was intrigued by the reverence in Philip's voice.
"What was your father like?"
Philip leaned back in his chair. "He was generous and quick to forgive. He was a man of principle, of high moral character. He was respected by all who knew him."
He glanced at me.
"He was a gentleman in every sense of the word."
"And you want to be just like him?"
I could see it in his countenance.
"Of course," he said.
I suddenly realized that my insult when I met him at the inn must have been especially cutting. I didn't know, when I said what I did at the inn, I didn't know what it would mean to you. I must have offended you deeply. I am sorry.
He smiled ruefully. I have never needed an insult more than I did that night. Please don't apologize for it.
I watched Philip intently, drawn to his easy smile and the way his eyes softened when he spoke of his father. All I knew about him were the few little crumbs he had cast my way. I was hungry for more. "What books did you bring back from your tour?" I asked. "Anything that caught my eye. I wasn't as selective as my father. He read mostly philosophy and religion. I picked up histories and mythology and poetry." He gestured to the book I had been looking at earlier. I found that one in a tiny bookstore in Paris that my father had told me about. The owner knew my father from his numerous trips there. He had a shelf of philosophy books that he pointed me to, and I think he was quite surprised when I bought the poetry instead. I smiled at the picture he had painted. "What else did you do on your tour?" Philip spread his hands. "A year of traveling around Europe is difficult to sum up."
"Then don't sum it up. Tell me everything."
I blushed at how eager and demanding I sounded.
"I didn't mean to say it like that. It's just..."
I shook my head and didn't know if I should even go on. But Philip asked, "What is it?" And he looked so curious that I tried to finish my thought. "It's different in Bath. I have only my grandmother and aunt for companions. My grandmother talks only if she has a criticism to make, and my aunt has more hair than wit. We never go out much in society because my grandmother doesn't like people, so I've been rather starved for good conversation."
"I imagine it's more than conversation you've been missing. Haven't you also been starved for friendship?"
He said it with a soft look around his eyes, and my pride flared suddenly.
"I didn't say that to make you feel sorry for me, and I don't want friendship if it's based on pity."
My voice sounded sharper than I had intended. Philip studied me for a minute. I held his gaze with defiance.
"I understand that better than you may believe," he finally said. His words effectively disarmed me.
"Do you?" I asked, surprised.
He looked pensively out the window.
"You don't want to be loved for your misfortune. I don't want to be loved for my possessions. Are we not similar in that way?"
When he turned his gaze to me, his expression reminded me of how he had looked when showing me the portrait of his elder brother Charles. The look of loss in his eyes tugged at my heart, daring me to ask a question. "Did somebody love you for your possessions?" Philip should have looked offended by my personal question, but instead he smiled a little and asked,
"Did somebody love you for your misfortunes?"
"No."
"But you're afraid someone might?"
I nodded, thinking of how I hated imposing on others simply because I depended on them.
"Then we're similar in that way, too."
His gaze held mine, and understanding passed between us in a look.
"Well then," I said.
I watched Philip's lip curl into a smile at the same time that mine did. He leaned toward me and said in a low voice,
"I promise not to love you for your misfortunes."
I blushed at the idea of saying the words "promise" and "love you" in the same sentence to Philip, but I had to return the vow. Anything else would be rude. "And I promise not to love you for your possessions." There, I had said it. I felt daring and bold. Maybe that was why I had the strange urge to grin. My cheeks ached with the effort of forcing my mouth into a moderate smile. I picked up the book as a distraction. "I would still like to hear more about your tour, unless I'm keeping you from something."
"I am wholly at your disposal, Marianne. But I wouldn't want to bore you with stories of my travels."
"Bore me?"
I stared at him.
Philip, I have never been outside of England. I've never even been to London. Do you know what I would give for your experiences? How could you possibly think that you would bore me? He didn't answer, but there was such a look of delight in his eyes that I had to ask, "Why are you looking at me like that?" "You called me Philip for the first time." I blushed. It was true. I had called him by his Christian name, but surely it wasn't my fault. He was the one who insisted on calling me Marianne and told me to stop calling him Sir. "It's only because your horrible manners are rubbing off on me," I muttered. He laughed. "I am glad to hear it." I didn't know how to answer, but thankfully I didn't have to because Philip asked, "Where shall I begin?" "Paris." Philip told me more about the little bookstore where he had found the book of poetry, then about the palace at Versailles, and the balls and assemblies he had attended. He told me about the Notre Dame Cathedral, and then he walked to the bookshelf, looking around vaguely for a minute. I went to the spot where I had been browsing before and pulled out the book on Gothic architecture. "Was this what you were looking for?" He flashed a smile at me as he took the book and set it on the table in front of us. He pointed out the various features he had seen on the cathedral, turning the pages rapidly, his voice growing rich with interest. From Paris, he moved to Italy, Venice and Rome and Florence. He stood again, and this time searched for a few minutes before coming back with a book of sketches. He handed it to me and let me look through them at my leisure, pointing to statues he had seen, talking about the artists and the preservation of the work. He told me about Italian operas and the time he had stayed in a villa on the coast where the water was so clear that he could see to the bottom of the ocean. After Italy came Austria and Switzerland, the Alps, the songs, the beautiful countryside, and more books. He brought me a book on Bavaria and a book of traditional Austrian folk songs. I asked him to sing one for me. His voice was low and rich and easy to listen to, not forced or unnatural. It was a very pleasant sound. As Philip talked, his eyes lit up. He gestured with his hands as he spoke. And when he smiled, his whole face was bright and captivating. After a while, I didn't have to ask questions. He just talked, and I could sit there with my chin on my hand, feasting on stories and images and ideas foreign to my own. Philip opened up worlds to me with his words. I had no sense of time, and the overcast sky hid the passage of the sun from view, entrapping us in one endless enchanted moment. I only noticed the outside world when Philip paused at the end of a story and I heard voices outside the library. They pierced the bubble I had been suspended in, and I felt the world and time rush back at me. I did not want it to come back. I wanted to pull myself back into the hours that had just passed. I wanted to shut the door and let the rain go on and keep myself right here for forever. But Philip paused, and his silence marked the end of our time together. "I love this room," I said with a sigh, reluctant to leave.
"You're welcome here any time."
"This is your sanctuary." I knew as soon as I had seen Philip in here that this was his orchard. I wouldn't want to intrude.
"Not even if I asked you to?" he asked with a smile.
"Oh, well," I didn't know how to respond. I blushed at my own awkwardness. "You're too kind."
"I'm not too kind. The library is for everyone, and you should consider yourself free to come here whenever you like."
"Thank you, and thank you for spending the day with me. I can't remember when I've enjoyed a day more. Not in a long time." He reached a hand across the small space between our chairs. I put mine in it naturally, instinctively. He leaned toward me, his blue eyes twinkling, his smile as warm as a patch of sunlight.
"The pleasure was all mine, Marianne."
I felt trapped in his gaze.
I was suddenly overcome with the sensation that if I looked deeply enough into Philip's eyes, I would find a beautiful, important secret. I drew in a breath, and as I did, I leaned closer. The sensation grew stronger, convincing me that it was only the distance between us that was keeping me from uncovering the truth. If I leaned toward him, something would happen. I was sure of it. But if I leaned away, nothing would happen. So I stayed perfectly still, balanced between something and nothing, not knowing which way I wanted to fall. Philip stayed perfectly still too, as though waiting for me to decide. His eyes, though, were not standing by like impartial witnesses to my decision. His eyes were persuading me that I wanted that something. They were inviting me closer, drawing me closer, convincing me to lean, to fall, to dive into their blue depths and never resurface.
Oh, pardon me.
Mr. Clumpet's voice suddenly broke over me. I startled, as if awakened from a dream, and pulled my hand out of Philip's grip. The sensation I had experienced vanished like smoke from a snuffed candle, leaving behind wisps of nameless longing. Of course, Philip had left the door to the library open. He was such a gentleman that way, but I wondered what his uncle had seen. Had he seen me gazing into Philip's eyes for that long moment? My cheeks burned at the thought. Philip stood and turned toward Mr. Clumpet, who had halted a few steps inside the room. Mr. Clumpet cleared his throat.
"Didn't realize you two were having a tête-à-tête in here. The door was open, you know."
His eyes flicked to the maid in the corner, who had been diligently dusting all afternoon.
"Yes, I know," Philip said with a smile in his voice. "Did you need something?"
Mr. Clumpet held up a book.
"This didn't mention anything about the Indian rhinoceros. I was looking for a companion to this volume."
He tilted his head back, letting his gaze traverse the high bookshelves with a hopeless expression.
"You wouldn't happen to know, would you, if such a thing can be found in here?"
"I'm not entirely sure," Philip said, with a look that was part amusement and part pity. Mr. Clumpet heaved a sigh and approached a bookshelf. He shook his head and muttered something that sounded like disorganized. Glancing at the clock on the mantel, I was shocked to see that it was nearly 6 o'clock and time to change for dinner. Had I really spent the entire day here? "We never did play chess, you know," I said to Philip. "I'm sorry."
"Don't apologize," Philip said.
"Our conversation was much more enjoyable than a game of chess. And now I have a reason to claim your time another day. Do you have plans tomorrow afternoon?" The only plans I had made were to immerse myself in the loveliness of the estate. I told him so, and he smiled and said, "Meet me here after lunch, then." I left the library feeling a decided urge to do something close to twirling. As I walked to my bedchamber to change for dinner, I wondered what had happened to me today. Something had happened. Of that I was certain. Where before I had been partially empty, now I felt something full inside, complete. It was a feeling as buoyant as sunlight. Examining my heart, I found that there were pieces of me that had gone missing in Bath that I had found once again today with Philip. And they were pieces of happiness. I entered my room with a smile on my face, knowing who was responsible for the happiness I had found. Philip had become a friend today, and I had not known until that moment how much I had missed the company of a friend. Perhaps I had never known before today the value of such a friend, a person to whom one could talk for hours without noticing the passage of time. Although I had had many friends in my life, I had never known how it felt to be accepted and esteemed so completely and so immediately. A letter rested on my writing desk, catching my attention while Betsy brought out a gown for me to change into for dinner. My initial excitement at seeing the envelope changed to disappointment when I realized it was merely Mr. Whittle's poem, which he had given to me before I had left Bath. Betsy must have removed it before taking my gown to be laundered. While I dressed, I thought of Mr. Whittle's and how relieved I was to be done with him. I had been very fortunate to come here and find such a warm welcome among the Wyndhams. But to simply enjoy my current state of happiness with no thought of others seemed very self-centered. Perhaps I could do something to help Aunt Amelia win her heart's desire. Mr. Whittle's needed only a nudge in the right direction, and I felt sure he would be very happy with my aunt. Her sincere admiration would stroke his ego quite nicely, and she was not an unattractive woman. I slipped the poem into the drawer of my writing desk, determined to come up with a way to bring those two together. Chapter 11. When I met Philip in the library the next afternoon for our game of chess, he said, "I know it's not as exciting as fencing, but I wondered if you would be interested in archery." I was interested in almost anything that took me away from the quiet pastimes of the drawing room. We went outside to the southeast lawn where a target had been set up for us. A couple of servants stood nearby, and Philip motioned for me to go first. We practiced until my arms were too tired to shoot one more arrow. As we walked back to the house, Philip said lightly, "I suppose the chess will have to wait until tomorrow." But the next afternoon, when I met him in the library, he asked if I had seen the gardens yet. I hadn't, so he took me on a tour of the grounds and showed me the water garden and the oriental garden and the rose garden. We talked and strolled around the grounds until a sudden rain shower drove us inside. I was surprised once again to discover that hours had passed while I was in Philip's company, though it had felt like mere minutes. And when I tried to account for the passage of time by recalling exactly what we had talked about, I could only remember bits and pieces, a story here, a memory there, and the fact that I had never had to search for something to say to him. Days blended together, and between our morning rides, our afternoon activities, dinner, and time spent with the family in the evening, there was hardly a moment when I was out of Philip's presence. I felt as if I were enjoying a guilty pleasure, and that I should turn my mind to something more productive than enjoying my new friendship with Philip. But I felt as wild and free as a bird suddenly released from its cage. I grew unguarded and blissfully happy and content to the very core of my soul. And although only a handful of days passed in this matter, I felt as if I had known Philip all my life. Philip and I had taken 5 rides together, and he had beaten me 5 times, when a letter arrived for me one morning. I was frustrated, because I knew that Meg had untapped potential within her, and I was determined to prove it. "One of these days, you will be seeing the backside of Meg," I told Philip as I sat down to breakfast. He laughed with a familiar glint in his eyes that made me think he was enjoying a secret. He had too many secrets. I narrowed my eyes at him, but by now I knew him too well to hope that he would reveal any of his mysteries to me. The butler cleared his throat as he held a silver salver toward me. On it rested a letter. The envelope bore Grandmother's familiar, shaky handwriting. She must have mailed this immediately after I left Bath for it to have arrived so soon. I set it beside my plate and looked at it with misgiving. Seeing it made me anxious, as if I had been living in a dream. I feared whatever the letter contained would cause me to wake. I decided to read it later, in private. Lady Caroline spoke up.
"I think we ought to host a ball for our guests while they're here. What do you all think?"
Mrs. Clumpett looked up with her ready smile.
"Oh, I love a ball. And so does Mr. Clumpett, don't you, my dear?"
I couldn't imagine that he actually loved a ball, but he grunted in response.
"Philip,"
Lady Caroline said,
"do you have any objections? You know you have free rein here, Mother.
That seemed odd. Why should she have to ask his permission to hold a ball?
If she needed to ask anyone, it should have been Sir Charles.
"I think a ball will be delightful," she said. "We'll introduce Marianne to all the eligible gentlemen in the area and watch them fight over her. What fun it will be!"
I looked at her in surprise and blushed. "I am sure you're mistaken about the level of interest I will inspire," I murmured.
"I am never mistaken about such things," she said, smiling like a cat before a dish of cream. "What do you think, Philip? Won't she be all the rage?"
I couldn't look at Philip. He would undoubtedly say something polite, which everyone would know was a lie. But then, when he didn't immediately answer, I had to look at him. I was so surprised by what I saw that I looked twice. Philip held his mother's gaze with a hard look in his eyes. A muscle jumped in his jaw. He almost looked angry, but I couldn't fathom why her words would spark such a reaction in him. Lady Caroline's smile turned hard, almost mocking, from across the table. After a tense silence, he finally said, "Undoubtedly." I took a quick breath. Something was amiss here, and it made me uncomfortable to think the cause of it. "A ball sounds wonderful," I said, wanting to clear the tension. "But I have no desire to be fought over. I would rather just enjoy the dancing." Mr. Clumpet suddenly looked up from his book.
"This sounds very much like something I just read."
He flipped through some pages while I looked at him in surprise. I didn't think he had been listening to us at all.
"Ah, here it is."
He cleared his throat before reading.
"The male rhinoceros will not tolerate any other male entering his territory during mating season. If such a thing occurs, dangerous fights are bound to ensue."
He looked up with bright eyes.
"That would be a sight to see, wouldn't it? A dangerous rhinoceros fight?"
"Fascinating," his wife said with feeling. I stared. Had he really just read something over breakfast about animals mating? I didn't know where to look in my embarrassment. Philip cleared his throat, but it sounded to me as if he was trying not to laugh.
"Very apropos," Lady Caroline said with a smile.
"Well then, it is settled. I will organize the guest list and start writing the invitations this afternoon."
I took that as permission to excuse myself. I was eager to escape the charged emotions of the room. I picked up my letter and walked to the door, but I felt a gaze on my back as I did so, and I glanced over my shoulder. Philip was watching me with a very solemn expression. I gave him a questioning look in return. Abruptly he smiled, and all traces of that foreign look were erased. It lingered in my mind, though, as I left the dining room. In that moment, Philip had reminded me very much of someone else, but I couldn't think of whom. I sat at the writing desk in my room and stared at Grandmother's letter for several minutes before daring to open it. Finally, I succumbed to the inevitable and broke the seal. The morning sunlight slanted through the window and warmed my back as I read.
"Dear Marianne,
I imagine you have already started scampering about the countryside like some farmer's brat, so I am writing to remind you of the conditions of your visit. You are to learn all you can from the Wyndhams about how to behave like an elegant young lady. Write to me and tell me what you are learning. Consider this an assignment. If I do not recognize some signs of improvement in you, I will not hesitate to call you home. If you cannot change your ways, I will not hesitate to cut you off without a penny, just as I did to my nephew. I am committed to this plan, and I will see you become all that you can be, both for your own future happiness, as well as for what you owe the family name. Do not disappoint me. Sincerely, Grandmother."
I gazed out the window while considering the ramifications of Grandmother's message.
The fact that she had mailed it before I had been absent 1 week illustrated her lack of faith in me. I had to smile as I admitted to myself that her lack of faith in me was partly justified, for I had not given one moment's thought to her assignment since I had fallen into the river. In fact, that event, falling in the river, highlighted the problem perfectly. I did not have the instincts of an elegant lady, but according to my grandmother, I would have to become an elegant lady in order to win an inheritance. As I considered this quandary, I did not attempt to deceive myself. Young ladies of elegant birth, with no fortune, had little hope for comfort in the world. Work was not an option, and marriage, without a sizable dowry, well, only the very blessed achieved that. I did not need a mirror before me to know that I was not among the very blessed. My figure was too petite for the current trend in beauty, and my looks, while passable, did not have the striking quality needed to attract a gentleman's attention. Besides that, the fact remained that I had no desire to be married simply for the achievement of it. That was Cecily's ambition, and I had learned at a young age that if I ever wanted the same thing Cecily wanted, I would inevitably lose to her. It was the doll that had made that point clear to me. When we were 6, our great aunt had sent us a doll she had bought in Paris. She wrote in the letter accompanying the package that it was unique in the whole world. It was finely made, with hazel eyes and real curled auburn hair. Having no children of her own, it did not occur to my great aunt what problems one doll between 2 girls would present. Cecily and I fought over it the moment it arrived. Of course, we were meant to share it, and sharing may have come later, but we fought over the right to be the first to hold that doll. Since Cecily was the eldest, she claimed that right. It didn't matter that it was only by 7 minutes. Those 7 minutes were a lifetime between us and could never be made up. So she held the doll first. Something fierce and unyielding grew within my young heart as I watched my sister stroke the doll's pretty auburn hair and hug it to her chest. I despised the feeling of losing to her, and I decided in a moment of jealousy and resentment that I would do anything rather than lose to her again. So when it was my turn to hold the doll, I claimed that I didn't want to touch the ugly thing. No matter how much Cecily held and caressed the doll and talked about how pretty it was, I remained stoically insistent that I did not want to touch it. And I never did. 11 years passed, and I never once touched that doll, not even to feel her hair. A maid once put it on my bed by mistake, but even then I did not touch it. I put a handkerchief over my hand and picked up the doll by the foot and flung it onto Cecily's bed. At first, it was only possessions we fought over, but as we grew older, the list lengthened. Talents, beauty, attention from boys. I applied the lesson of the doll and decided it was better to want something different from Cecily instead of lose to her. I learned to hide my desires, or to change them as soon as learning hers. There was nothing I could do to become more beautiful than she was. But when she excelled at singing, rather than trying to match her, I refused my lessons and turned my focus instead to painting. When she proved herself a devoted flirt, I scorned such artifice and either avoided talking to eligible gentlemen or deliberately spoke my mind to them, which I discovered they did not like. I had to be different from Cecily, so I would not be inferior. We could not occupy the same space together. Like horses in a race, I was tired of jostling for position and losing. I chose a different course so that losing would not be an option. And so, while she planned her season and dreamed of the achievements she would make with her marriage, I did the opposite. She planned to marry someone wealthy, entitled and with a good parcel of land. I dreamed quietly of marrying someone whom I loved deeply and who loved me madly in return. If such a man could not be found, then I would not marry at all. Such was my attitude when Cecily and I came of age to be presented to society and enter the marriage mart in London. Cecily dreamed of nothing but town life. I dreamed of nothing but living comfortably in the country. I did not envy Cecily her season, because I had no such ambition. I did not aspire to a brilliant match, because it would be a contest with Cecily, and she would win. I never wanted to be an elegant lady, because that was Cecily's role. But now, faced with this challenge from Grandmother, I realized I would be foolish to throw away a fortune simply because I had never been ambitious in the same way Cecily was. I might not have planned to be a wealthy heiress, but only a simpleton would turn down an opportunity to live very comfortably for the rest of her life. In fact, this inheritance was exactly what would give me the freedom to choose whether or not I married for love. And all I had to do to earn it was to prove myself an elegant young lady. I was certainly not entirely hopeless in that regard, or else my grandmother would not have given me a chance to try. I would try, and I would earn the inheritance that would give me unparalleled freedom. But there was another hope that lived in my heart, the hope that if I proved myself, my father might come home. If he could be proud of me, he might return. I might be able to go home. I might be able to convince him to stay and let me take care of him. With my inheritance from Grandmother, we would live comfortably. He would want to keep me there, and he would want to stay with me, and I would never have to wonder again if I was wanted. At the thought of my father, I remembered where I had seen the look that Philip had given me as I walked out of the dining room. I propped my chin on my hand and remembered the day shortly after my mother's funeral when I had passed by my father's study. He had held a framed portrait of my mother in one hand, and his eyes were cast downward as he gazed on her image. He did not see me, and so I caught him in a private moment where concern for me did not guard his expression. His expression was exactly what I had seen in Philip's countenance. At the time, I had thought it was only a look of grief, but recollecting it now, after seeing it so clearly on Philip's face, I thought, perhaps, it wasn't grief I had seen, but longing. But no, I must have been mistaken, or else he had been thinking of someone else. There was no earthly reason for Philip Wyndham to ever look at me with longing. My cheeks suddenly warmed. I banished the thought from my mind and turned my attention to responding to Grandmother's letter. Dear Grandmother, I am happy to report that I am getting along very well here. There are plenty of cows, and the farmers have been quite eager to teach me the secrets of milking. With any luck, I shall be proficient at it before I leave so that I may have a trade to fall back on should I fail to meet your expectations. In the meantime, here is what I have learned so far about being an elegant young lady. An elegant young lady should never insult a gentleman she might have to dine with later. If she feels inclined to twirl, she should watch out for patches of mud, and she should learn how to sing at least one song so that she won't die of fright if she is called upon to perform. Give my love to Aunt Amelia. Yours, Marianne. I smiled as I imagined what she might make of this letter. It would surely frustrate her, but it would probably also make her laugh. She had a throaty laugh, which was always given up reluctantly when it was given up at all, and that made it so much more worth the earning. It was something I was proud of, being able to make her laugh or smile when she normally repressed such instincts. In this, Cecily did not share the same talent as I. My twin might outshine me in other accomplishments, but she had never made Grandmother's grey eyes twinkle with suppressed amusement, and she had certainly never earned a laugh from her. It was not a charitable thought, but one which made my heart swell with pleasure, nonetheless. Despite my flippant response to Grandmother, I did feel the need to focus some of my attention on her assignment. And so, after I sealed the letter to her, I took another piece of paper and made a list. If I were going to improve myself, I needed to be honest about my failings. Marianne's list of improvements. Stop twirling. Wear a bonnet outside. Learn to sing at least one song for company. Learn to flirt with gentlemen. That seemed like enough to work on for now, and I did not want to overwhelm myself. Heaven knew the last one on the list might be impossible. But I knew there was one more item I should add, although it was more general than specific in nature. Follow the example of other elegant young ladies. I knew this would mean having to sit at tea with them and talk about the things they were interested in, like bonnets and lace and such. But if doing so meant bringing my father home, I would try. If it meant avoiding my return to Bath, then I would try. After finishing my list, I took my letter downstairs and found Mrs. Clumpet, who had mentioned wanting to walk to Lambden, the nearest village. She agreed to accompany me to mail my letter. I felt proud of myself that I remembered to wear a bonnet.
"This is a fortuitous timing," she said. "Mr. Clumpet has just asked me to join him in a search for a certain species of beetle, and although I enjoy exploring the woods, I do not like insects."
I welcomed her company. There was something odd, but at the same time pleasant about her. She did not prattle on about inconsequential things like bonnets and fashion. She knew about things I had never considered, and she seemed to be an equal to her husband in terms of her quest for knowledge. I liked how she had been able to hold her own in their debate over dinner about the jungle bush quail. But I doubted she was what my grandmother had in mind when she told me to make myself into an elegant young lady. As we walked into town together, it occurred to me that she looked nothing like her sister, Lady Caroline. Mrs. Clumpet stood no taller than I, and although there was no real fault to find in her nose, or her chin, or her eyes, there was also no real asset to any of those features. Except for her upturned lips, it was a forgettable face. Lady Caroline, though, was a true beauty, from her rich brown hair to her dark blue eyes, from her statuesque figure to her high cheekbones and aquiline nose. Noticing the differences between them made me like Mrs. Clumpet even more. We had something in common, the two of us. We had both been cursed with beautiful sisters. After mailing my letter, I found a shop where I bought a sketchbook, pencils, paper, and paint supplies, along with a satchel to carry everything. The idea of painting had taken such a hold of me that I felt the need to do something about it. Besides, I would like something of Edenbrook to take away with me when I left. It was the closest thing to paradise I had ever known, and I wanted to remember it always.
"Are you an artist?" Mrs. Clumpet asked as she helped me carry my purchases.
"No, not at all," I said with a laugh, "but I do enjoy it, and I hope to improve myself. It is one of the socially acceptable talents for a young lady to possess, you know."
"Hmm,"
she slanted a glance at me.
"I hope you are not offended by my saying this, Miss Marianne. But I think there are more important things to consider than what talents are socially acceptable."
I smiled to myself. It was all very well for Mrs. Clumpet to be a little odd and something of a blue stocking. She was married and appeared to be well matched. I, on the other hand, still had to secure my future happiness, and I knew that my future depended entirely on my becoming socially acceptable. "I'm not sure my grandmother would agree," I murmured. Mrs. Clumpet laughed.
Neither would mine. But I hope you do not let anyone else's expectations direct the course of your life.
She gently touched my arm, stopping me in the path. I turned toward her.
I have discovered happiness in being true to who I am. I hope you will give that idea some consideration.
I nodded, touched that she seemed to care enough about me to offer such heartfelt advice. I will consider it, thank you. A cart coming down the path called me to attention, and I stepped aside to let it pass. Riding in the cart was a plump woman. She was holding on to her hat with one hand and gripping the side of the cart with the other as she was jostled about on her seat. She looked up just as the cart was passing us and suddenly grabbed the arm of the driver.
"Please, stop here!"
"Why, it's Mrs. Natalie," I said, hurrying towards her. I had not heard anything from her about James, so I had assumed everything was going well with his recovery. Mrs. Nutley clambered down gingerly from the cart and walked to us with small, quick steps.
"I was just on my way to Edenbrook to see you."
She grasped my hand, and I noticed a wrinkled handkerchief clutched in her other hand. I wondered why she was not at the inn taking care of James.
"I do not know what to think," Mrs. Nutley said, dabbing at her eyes. "I only meant to stretch my legs. I walked down the path only in its way. But when I returned to the inn, James was gone."
Chapter 12. I sat on the edge of my chair and watched Mrs. Nutley sip her tea. She seemed calmer now that we had her settled in the comfortable drawing-room at Edenbrook, but I felt sorry that she had spent so much time worrying about James and whether it was her fault he had disappeared. Lady Caroline joined us in the drawing-room and gently posed questions to Mrs. Nutley.
"He was returning to good health?"
"Yes, I was taking excellent care of him. In fact, the doctor had visited early yesterday and said James looked healed enough to go home in the next few days."
"Has anything unusual happened that may explain his disappearance?"
Lady Caroline asked.
"No, not today." She set down her teacup. "But now that I think of it, something unusual did happen yesterday. I came downstairs while James was resting and saw a gentleman speaking with the innkeeper. The gentleman asked if a young lady had recently stayed the night. The innkeeper told him that yes, there had been. Then the gentleman asked if she had a companion with her. The innkeeper told him, yes, her maid. I thought, of course, of you, Miss Daventry."
"What did this gentleman look like?" I asked.
"Rather dashing," I thought. "I noticed he carried a walking cane."
Mrs. Nutley could have been describing any number of young gentlemen in the area, and a walking cane was certainly not an unusual accessory.
"What else did the innkeeper tell him?" Lady Caroline asked.
"Why, he told him that you had left the inn and were on your way to Edenbrook."
She turned worried brown eyes to me. I chewed on my lip as I wondered who might be looking for me and why. A run-of-the-mill highwayman wouldn't come looking for his latest victim. But who else would guess that I had stayed at that inn? And who would care? That afternoon, I met Philip in the library with the intention of finally playing that game of chess. But it was a beautiful day, and when he suggested an excursion instead, I could not resist the temptation. He had the horses saddled while I fetched my sketchbook, and then we rode to the top of the knoll. It was the same spot he had led me to the first morning we rode together. The same groom accompanied us, and when we reached the top of the knoll, he led the horses to graze nearby, while Philip and I chose a shady spot beneath the large tree. From where I sat, I could look around and see almost all of Edenbrook below me. We talked while I sketched, and sometimes Philip just watched me in silence. It was a comfortable stretch of moments together. We had been silent for some time when Philip suddenly asked, "Where is your father?"
"A little village in France."
I felt sad saying the words,
Have you any idea if he is coming home soon? I studied him before answering, surprised by his question. But he didn't look at me, and I could read nothing from his profile. No, I have no idea what his plans are. And then Philip did turn to me, in time to see the flare of sadness I felt at the thought of my father's absence. His eyebrows contracted in an expression of concern.
Do you want him to come home?
I sighed and plucked a blade of grass. Of course I do. I hoped that would be the end of his line of questioning, but Philip said,
Does he know how you feel?
I shrugged. I've never told him in so many words. I haven't wanted to. If he is happier there, then that is where he should be.
You spend so much time thinking about other people's feelings, he said quietly. I wonder how much thought you give to your own. Is your father more deserving of happiness than you are?
I took a deep breath, struggling to push my emotions back down to their normal level. Philip, somehow, in the hours I had spent with him, had developed a special ability to unravel my defenses and access secrets that I didn't share with anyone. Today his words plucked at the sore parts of my heart, tearing off raw bits of sadness. Philip was waiting for a response, his serious blue eyes on me. Perhaps, I said, striving to sound light, when inside I felt like weeping. He shook his head.
I disagree.
I didn't want to discuss this any more. Let's not talk about that, not when the day has been so pleasant. I forced a smile and waved the piece of grass at the view before us. Look at all this beauty before you. Wouldn't you rather just enjoy it?
I am looking at it, he said, never taking his eyes off of me. And I am enjoying it, he added with a smile and a wink.
My face grew hot even as his smile grew. He had only said that about my supposed beauty to make me blush. I hated that he could affect me with just a look or some pretty words, and I hated that he wanted to affect me, as if I were a plaything to him. I frowned and threw the piece of grass at him. Can you never be serious for more than 2 minutes?
What makes you think I'm not serious?
He asked, looking up at me through his lashes. I shook my head, utterly exasperated. I had done everything in my power to discourage Philip from flirting with me, from scowling at him to ignoring him to scolding him. But nothing worked. He still insisted on trying to flirt with me every time we were together. Didn't he know that if I ever attempted to flirt back with him, it would change everything, ruin everything? Because then we would not simply be friends. We would be friends who flirted. And I would be a dismal failure at it. I felt he should not treat our friendship with so little care. But perhaps it didn't mean to him what it meant to me. Perhaps he could afford to lose me as a friend. I stood up, suddenly very upset, and took a step away from him. Philip grabbed the hem of my gown.
Wait,
he said, laughing. I looked down at him, my hands clenched into fists.
Please don't leave,
he said, a cajoling smile turning his lips up charmingly. I won't do it again. Well, at least he knew why I was upset. But the idea of him not doing it again? Ha! I raised an eyebrow in deep skepticism. In the next 5 minutes, he added with a chuckle. I tried to stay angry with him. But he looked so endearing, smiling up at me, holding on to the hem of my gown as a child might cling to his mother. Right then, I could imagine him as a little boy with his soulful blue eyes and chestnut curls. He must have been adorable. My heart thawed. It would have to be made out of stone not to. I felt a smile twitch at my lips. And at that instant, I knew that Philip would always be able to charm me out of a bad mood. I sat down again and looked at the view, fighting against a smile. I finally said, "You're very good at that, you know."
"At what?"
I could hear the smile in his voice. "Charming me into a good humor."
just like you're good at making me laugh.
Am I? I turned to him in real curiosity. I hadn't realized that I had sat down closer to him than I had been before. So when I turned to him suddenly, leaning toward him in my curiosity, I discovered Philip.